Good afternoon. It's 5:30 in the UK on Tuesday, March the 6th, and welcome to this week's What Comes Next Live podcast. My guest this week is A.D. Holt. He is my 107th guest on the show out of 111 shows, which go back to after with some hiatus last year to June the 30th, 2020, in the middle of the pandemic. Why am I remarking on the fact there's 107th guest, 111 shows? All shall become clear. Welcome, A.D.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom. Good to be here.
So as with many of the guests that come on, they say, what questions are you going to ask and what do you want to talk about? And the answer is always the same. It's your space. You and I met a number of weeks ago, about a month ago, at the monthly walk and talk and drink that mutual friend and past alumnus of the show, Ben Braben, hosts on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 5 o'clock at Green Park. And yes, for the audience, if you'd like to come along, you can. And we had a little wander through the park and chatted about a few things and only just scratched the surface of all the things that are on your mind, that you're up to, that you're, in short, I wanted to learn more. So here we are. So what's top of mind for you, A.D.?
Great to be here, Tom. And I think the sum total of what we were discussing very briefly in the park was all about human connections.
Yeah.
So, you know, the next half hour I expect to be strongly related to human connections. I suppose it's worth just sharing with the audience a little bit of where I came from and how I ended up in that park with you in the first place. And I, you know, my career started way back when, in 1989, trying to play golf and failing miserably. And working out, it's probably better if I did something else. So I joined the Air Force and did 23 years there. But it was only towards the end of my career when I get hoiked out and asked to help establish one of Defence's more radical innovation units, an organisation called the J-Hub, that my career really took a different direction. We got hoiked out of our 1950s construct, typical sort of MOD buildings, and put into a WeWork in the East End of London. And we were charged with learning from the best innovators in the world, people like Google and Amazon and Deliveroo and whoever else was really making a difference at the time, to help the defense procurement boat go faster. How could we get capability into the hands of the user faster at the front line? And that was the first time really I was in that sort of super fast, super dynamic startup ecosystem kind of environment. And it was really interesting to be there at the intersection of big business, government, and those little businesses trying to make headway and actually doing some of the R&D that the big entities couldn't afford to do on their own, almost for free out in Shoreditch, and inventing some things that government and defense certainly needed quite desperately. But one of the mantras that we had back then was your network is your net worth. And I know it sounds trite. It came out of Silicon Valley. It's typical kind of, you know, slips off the tongue, doesn't mean anything kind of phrase. But actually, it really does mean something. Because I came to realize through that experience and some subsequently that it really is the power of your network that determines what you manage to achieve in life. Mm. I think it was Arnold Schwarzenegger put really quite well recently about the fact how angry gets when people refer to him as self-made man. Nobody's self-made. Everybody's a product of their networks. But one of the metrics that we used to use back then was Dunbar's number 150. And that's the first time I became aware of it. And we used to use it in terms of our extended network. And of course, it's referenced in books like Sapiens, and many others have picked up on the fact that there is a limit to how many meaningful relationships a human without any kind of digital augmentation can hold. And it stems from simple evolutionary factors that built our society. It's common to a number of primates. We're not alone. Depending on brain to size ratio, I believe different primates have different social sizes to their networks. But, you know, the bigger ones, the great apes, are not massively different to us. It's around about 150. And through a long process I won't describe in detail, I ended up outside of the Air Force working for an organization called Scaling Partner. And Scaling Partner basically exists to help startups grow. Our role was to invest in and help startups grow. And one of the challenges is helping those people build networks.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we did to help them build their network was we found an excuse to get them in the room with people that they'd want to meet. It wasn't a hard sales or an obvious sales angle, but it was an opportunity for them to meet and build meaningful relationships with people, develop trust with people they wouldn't normally get the chance to meet. And we call it Author Insights. We bring an author in every 6 weeks or so, and we invite lots of interesting and influential people into the room, some who may well be prospects for our startups, some who are just really genuinely interesting people in their own right. And one of the authors we were fortunate enough to get was Robin Dunbar, Tracy Camilleri, and Samantha Rocky, his co-authors on their latest book, which is called The Social Brain. It was a huge privilege to be in the room with him. As you can imagine, having lived a few years thinking about the Dunbar number and then actually getting to meet the man and the team behind some of the research. So that's why the Dunbar number matters to me. And why was it top of my mind that day when we were walking around the park? Well, it's top of my mind because what I do now is I connect people and help them to succeed by building connections for people. And one of the paragraphs in The Social Brain talks to how important that role is and how undervalued it is in many companies and organizations simply because you can't put metrics on it. Right. So if you look at standard SDR practice, so sales development representatives, they can find metrics pretty easy. You know, it's how many telephone calls did you make? How many emails did you send? How many responses did you get?
Mm.
But trying to put metrics on meeting people, building trust, developing networks is really, really hard. But their research showed that it was super important. And I firmly believe it to be. And that's why we ended up with our conversation in the park.
All right. Before I'll come back to that, but there's a question that sits with me from you giving us a part of your bio. Moving from, we're 23 years in total in the Air Force. That'll be the UK Royal Air Force, right? For our international audience. Moving into a radical team, in your words, about innovation, work, super fast, super dynamic environment. What did that feel like for you as a human, moving from the old hierarchical environment into a super fast, super dynamic startup one?
For me personally, it was liberating because I found myself, you know, I went from a place I found quite stifling and difficult to operate in, and one that didn't always recognize me for me. It recognized me for the job it needed doing and my ability to do that job. Whereas when we moved over into the J Hub, all of a sudden the question was, what are you good at? Hmm. What do you enjoy doing? What do you thrive on? And how well can you do that in this community? And that's a different prospect altogether. So, you know, and I think it's a much more 21st century offer for any employee. Is what is it that you can do better than most people, probably because you enjoy it, rather than need that job doing, you're the square peg, I'm going to hit you as hard as I can into that round hole until the job gets done properly, which is, you know, the traditional way of doing things. Vanilla flavored jobs, get things done. So for me personally, I found it liberating. We were a very small team at the time. I think I was employee number 4, and I think most people that joined around that time were very similar to me and equally found it liberating. They'd all come from somewhere they found a bit constrained. They were all sort of being shoehorned into roles they weren't particularly comfortable with or been asked to do things that they weren't comfortable with either at this level or wherever they could see themselves going. As it got a little bit bigger, we did see some people who came in and found it a bit different, particularly because we had a very flat structure. So we'd get people that were 2 or 3 ranks above some of the people in the team, being told what to do by people that were in the team that had just been there a bit longer than them and knew the ropes better. And that caused a bit of friction, as you can imagine. Because
you were still serving members of the Air Force at that point.
Still serving military officers, not the Air Force. So it was tri-service. So you get some, you could potentially get some cheeky little RAF upstart telling some reasonably senior naval chap what to do, and they're just not, it's just not cut out for that. This isn't the way it works, you know. But we worked quite hard to keep the structure flat, and it was always the right person for the job that did the job, and everybody else helped them, and it was as simple as that.
So I want to ask you in a minute about metrics and network building and the importance of that.
Yeah.
But to connect a couple of dots, I mentioned in the intro that you're the 107th guest and the 111th show. There have been four repeat guests so far. And so that occurred to me because we were going to be talking a little bit about Dunbar's number of 150 meaningful connections as the most that people can manage. And I thought, well, 107 is, I knew it was well over 100, but 107 is 150. But I thought, I've never actually made a conscious focus on connecting those guests. The only common thread between them is I've spoken with all of them, right? And some will know each other really well. And I'll ask you a minute maybe to talk about the different concentric circles that come up to 150 and Dunbar's theory on that. But some of them know each other a little and some of them don't know each other at all. But there may be useful opportunities for people to connect to people. And as you said, the key word in any relationship is taking the time to develop, to build trust.
Hmm.
So we've done that. And a couple of dots I'll connect right away is you mentioned the liberating pieces, the two elements I picked up on is what are you good at and where do you thrive, is what you said, right? And I did quite a lot of research a number of years ago around the Japanese concept of ikigai. The short LinkedIn meme version was like three or four concentric Venn diagram circles that overlap. What are you good at? What do you love? What can you get paid for? And what does the world need is the fourth circle that got added in recent years. And that was popularized by one of the other past show guests, a guy called Mark Wynn from Guernsey. And when he put it out there, it went viral. And another past guest, one of the two repeat guests, because I got him to come on recently, is a guy called Dave Stewart from up in Scotland who runs the Fresh Air Leadership Company, who's ex-services as a senior officer in a division of the British Army. And he spends his time working with leadership teams, often, but not always in the open air. And one of the topics that he and I have talked about is different structures from, you know, the simplistic version of the shift in the British Army from command and control to what they call mission command, where they empower the earlier ranks. And one of the things I've come across talking to British Army or people in the British Army at different ranks is that those who've been around long enough that they didn't grow up with that newer system the last 15, 20 years tend to be very hierarchical and don't really like being lower ranks being empowered. In other words, a quasi flatter structure. But those who might be say mid-30s or below, so they will have been, if they start as an officer, they've got two or three ranks, but no further. It's completely automatic to them to ask a junior non-commissioned officer, like one of the early ranks, just ask them, what do you think?
Yeah.
And genuinely mean it. So those are two guests, Dave Stewart and Mark Wynn, that, I don't know, A.D. Holt might want to talk to. It's like at some point.
Connect. Yeah.
So that's just connecting some dots. And it is fascinating to me that the idea of the metrics, there's a guy I've not yet had on the show who is absolutely passionate about building a system sometimes, and he's thinking about using blockchain for it because every transaction, if you will, is maintained as part of a ledger. And the idea of being able to go, well, how did you meet so-and-so? Well, actually, if I take it right back to the very beginning, I talked to somebody 15 years ago, then it moved from here to here to here. And I was literally talking to my gardener today. I said, well, one of my busiest parts of my work is 7 or 8 time zones away. I said, well, how did you get that? I said, well, if I take you back to the original part of the story, it goes through 6 links over the last 14 years. But is there a metric for that? I mean, you know, it's interesting. If we are what we measure is one of those phrases. And if everybody is a product of your network, as you said, which I do, you know, believe that, wouldn't it be wonderful if we can actually measure the value of people who have a role, formal or informal, within any system or organization? Building that.
The opportunity to measure the quality of a network like that is really quite interesting. And I think the phrase that you used in terms of you become what you measure, I like to spin it a slightly different way and say you become what you do. And I can look at my own life and see a lot of that in myself. And I can't measure do. I can measure metrics. I can measure, obviously, you know, stats can be measured. You can't measure doing stuff, but I can see how my life was transformed by doing the job that was in front of me or doing the thing that I really believed in passionately side of desk until it became part of who I am.
Hmm.
And I think again, thinking about metrics, sometimes we get pulled into a vortex in believing them too much or relying on them too much, because you can measure them and you can show them to, and they can be really evocative. And I'll use again the example of the SDR. I don't want any SDRs to feel I'm bashing them, but if you hire sales development reps to make cold calls for your business, you're doing a couple of things. One is you're paying a lot of money for a lot of phone calls and emails.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is most of those people that receive those emails either aren't going to respond to them, or if they, or worse still, they may even be offended by them.
Yeah.
Now, of the tiny fraction that do respond, even smaller fraction then get converted into sales because they're probably the wrong people. I think the stats are something like 100 cold outreach calls, emails to one meeting, and 100 meetings to one sale from SDR leads is roughly the sort of stats that you can expect in the market. And that's a lot of reputational damage being done for all those ones that aren't turning into sales. But you can measure it, so people like it, which is bizarre, really. Trust-based sales, relationship-based sales, much, much harder to measure. But the stats, if they could be recorded, are probably much more significant. You're probably up in the sort of 20%, 10% kind of conversion rates. And you haven't offended anyone because you've had sensible conversations with people that may say no to your product or your idea or whatever it is, but at least they're not offended because you're bombarding them with emails every third Wednesday or whatever it might be. So I think sometimes it's difficult to extract ourselves from them, but we should be really cautious about statistics and more reliant on relationships.
I think I've got a couple of thoughts on that, and the more granular one is that part of what I've done over the years, quite a fair bit, is I have this unadvertised niche that I don't really work in anymore, but I used to, of helping professional service firm partners build their practice, build their client base. Mm. And it's improved a bit in recent years, but go back 10 years or so, it doesn't matter which country you're in, they were also, when they got partner on their badge, right, either a law associate or a senior manager or director in an accounting firm, they get told, go off to such and such a city, have 10 meetings a day, and go bring back some business. And they get asked when they get back to the office, how much new business did you bring in? What's the answer? None, right? And it would be like for every 10 meetings, you might get one or two interest, which means 6 months down the line, you might get something maybe, right? And the methodology I base is all about introductions from trust-based relationships. And the actual metrics are basically the actual metrics would be for every meeting, for every two meetings you get a good quality piece of work, like as in 50% conversion. So it's fascinating. It doesn't apply to everything. But, you know, my own conversion ratio is about 90% because people only come to me from referrals, like end of story. And those people who refer know me really well, know exactly the client for me and exactly what to do. It's just, I'm in a niche space. What I'd say in a bigger space is one of the clients I've been working with for years is a global multinational. And a bit about metrics and linking to what you're saying. Is they are absolutely rigorously focused on being led by their purpose, their promise to society, and their values. And every decision is based on that. That's to me, there's this phrase source and outcome. If you are what you do, agree with that, who you are. So you can be influenced by what you end up doing, or you can consciously choose to be a certain way and to do certain things. Mm-hmm. And if you actually hold the course on that, you will get the outcomes.
Mm.
The best will in the world, even with tens of thousands of people, I can tell you, I know that company extremely well. They have a good number of metrics, including the classic things like, you know, client surveys and employee engagement, all this kind of thing, right? But they also know that that's only part of the answer. The real answer, and by the way, this is an old fashioned professional services firm.
Mm.
The share price has outstripped Meta and Google in the last 3 years. And all they do is sell people's time and, you know, and project-based work. It's nothing radical, but they just have an incredible culture. So they're able to get the best clients and the best staff. But the key to the point is that they will partially find metrics, but they know that the source of everything is to, you are what you do. Do the right thing.
Yeah.
Which, not by coincidence, is actually one of their values. <It's> like...
There's a wonderful book which we actually hosted for Author Insights called Centennials by Professor Alex Hill. And it talks to some of what you're referring. It also references the Dunbar number, but it also talks to what you're describing there, which is understanding what it is to be a purposeful, sustainable business. And I don't mean sustainable in terms of, you know, the environment in this particular case, well, that's definitely part of it, but sustainable in the long term. And of course, that trust. You can, so much damage is done by corporations chasing the next quarter's results, driving SDRs to make more phone calls, get more deals. And there's some wonderful statistics around the fact that of all the catastrophic implosions, you know, the really big businesses that have ceased to exist catastrophically within, you know, months. Statistically, their best ever sales year was within 3 years of that collapse.
Wow.
And that is probably because what they're doing is they're getting the deals. They are flying across the Atlantic, meeting all those people, but annoying the hell out of them, getting a deal out of one of them, but annoying everybody else. And they're selling yesterday's products rather than developing new products for new clients. The stats look great for that year, but you've got nothing left in the tank afterwards. You've burned all your bridges. Nobody wants to speak to you. You've got no products. And that is the end of the business. It disappears. But taking that slightly more long-term human view is what builds organizations, not just businesses, but organizations that do last for 100 years.
Yeah, and then for audiences, there are, that Centennials is a really interesting book, looking at really old companies and what's their secret. And that Jim Collins wrote about that stuff, and Roman Kosnarek wrote about in the Good Ancestor. There's some terrific stuff around this. And you absolutely resonate. And several of the multinationals I know, that they do have to act like the one I was talking about, where, you know, they're doing really, really well. So what's the next quarter bring? What's the next quarter going to bring? And there are points where the internal conversations go, actually, we have grown so fast that not everybody is as embedded in who we are. So we'll actually have to slow down a little bit for a year or two.
This is it.
And you have to, and so in terms of building trust, there's a level there where, with the quarterly earnings calls of listed companies, et cetera, you have to get the investment community on side. So you can turn around to them and go, we're not going to give you the detail, but it's going to slow down for a while, guys, because in order for us to be who we've been for you and give you the investment returns the last number of years, we're asking you to trust us. When you can get to that point where they trust you to say, actually, our projections for the next few quarters will drop from where they were before because we're investing in making sure we can do this for the long term.
Yeah.
And it does take bravery from a CEO and a board and a leadership team to do that. And it is uncommon. I mean, you know, I tell people I only work with CEOs and leadership teams who are purpose-led, and they go, yeah, but they only care about money. Well, money's part of the picture. It's not my audience. They're not the people I talk to. Money is an important metric, right? But it's the outcome of doing all the source behaviors that which are going back to what you talked about, is about human connection.
Absolutely. I suppose we should talk about that, shouldn't we? Because we did promise to talk about Dunbar's number.
Yes, I was going to say, perhaps, you're very familiar with this, so give us your take on
I'll just talk about the things that I think are probably relevant to probably some of the people that might be interested in the podcast. And that is, so starting at the beginning, the Dunbar graph actually is a set of concentric circles that dictate the size of certain rings of influence we have in our social network. So the inner one is 1.5, you and your intimate partner. And then it goes up to 3, sort of, you know, close friends, family, then 5, then it goes to 15, then it goes to 50, then 150, 500, and 1500, roughly threefold every time. And you can see around the world that actually military organizations roughly follow those kind of numbers. You know, the sizes of their organizations are following those numbers. So humans have accidentally found the Dunbar number by themselves, but it's for good reason. It's because of our cognitive capacity to hold those relationships. And the important ones probably for most organizations are the smaller ones. So roughly 25. If you get to a team of 25, you don't really want to be going to 35. Yeah. Because 35 is going to feel a bit iffy. You want to split it off. or you want to take it to 50, where you've got another natural sort of balance. And it's those interim states are actually quite dangerous, particularly when you get up to 150 and you're getting to the limits of cognitive capacity. This is often one of the spaces where big corporations make a problem for themselves, because they try and, you know, give somebody responsibility for an organization that's like 175, 200, and people just can't do that. So you get fragmentation inside the organizations. And I personally think it's really important for me, because our networks are so complicated now. We're no longer leaning over the fence to talk to our village friends, that it's really hard to manage our networks. And we don't naturally know who's coming in and going out of them. People come in and go out of our networks all the time, but we don't manage and monitor that. So we end up with a circle of meaningful relationships that we haven't necessarily chosen. They're just the ones that we've let in and go out, and we don't necessarily monitor that. So I think there's a job to be done to help people get better at doing that. And I'm working on some bits at how we might be able to do it. But going back to the business side of things, that's very much the way I operate now in my new outfit, Form One Partners, is by trying to use an extended network of people to help our invested portfolio get to where they need to be. And interestingly, our network of advisors has just hit the 100 mark. And it's going to be really interesting to see how that pans out as it starts to stretch out towards the 150, and how we as the core team manage that network of people who are actually the engine room. They're the people that make those meaningful connections that make the whole business work.
That's interesting, because if we think of it, if we try to individualize that, so if you have advisors who you'll be putting into portfolio investment companies, etc., imagine it, you know, because I do a lot of mentoring, and I'm involved with developing mentoring networks. And sometimes they try to do it using data filters and automation, and sometimes they try to do it using a human. And how many connections can a human manage? And, you know, once you get over 100, it's quite a struggle to go, actually, I've got this new startup founder called AD Holt, and we need to find him an advisor for our network. And if you've got 30 people, you probably have had lunch with all of them in the last year. And you really know, not the stuff that it says on the database as to which industries they do, what their experience is, you know, oh, by the way, they also are about this. So, you know, it's building that deep and, as you said, meaningful connection is the Dunbar phrase. It is fascinating. There's one thing I want to just touch on is a lot of what I did for years was I was for a time involved with and then CEO of a global business coaching company. And we'd often work with smaller organizations, and we had numbers of our own. Sometimes revenue numbers, but also sometimes people numbers. Yeah. And they will vary, all the usual caveats. But generally, the idea of 3, 5, 15, and then 25, 35, 50, or whatever it is, if a company gets up, generally speaking, if a company that's people-led rather than product-led gets up to about 25, you have to make a fundamental change in the organization. You can't have the founder running it anymore. And you need to actually put in, corporatized is the language I use just to make the founders of startups squirm, a management tier, a management cadre, and you actually have to do that. But each of those, it's just interesting. So if I was to be pro bono mentoring a startup or a scale up, I'd say, what are your revenue numbers? What's your profit? Right? And of course, up until, you know, a year or two ago when everything tightened, they would go, oh no, we've got another three rounds of funding to do before we go for profit, you know, but you know, that's changing fast. What's your revenue? What's your profit? How many staff do you have? Right. And they'll tell me, and I already got in my mind, this will mean the following. Right. So it is, I think I hope that listeners and viewers will take away from this the value of actually studying these numbers and actually understand and just being really conscious of their network. Because the piece I also took away from you is, our own networks, how often do we curate those? How often do we look at who can we maintain the network with? I'll be sending in, as I touched on, I spent time before this call pulling together an email list for the 107 past guests. And when we finish, I'm going to send that email out to all the guests, up to my latest one, yourself. And in there is an apology, because for quite a number of those guests, I've not spoken to them for quite some time. Because how big a network can you be meaningfully connected to? So anyway, it's very thought provoking and entertaining, but also thought provoking and interesting. And I hope that we choose to add each other to our 150, so we can spend a bit more time together understanding each other better and seeing who we can connect each other to.
I think we probably got another podcast in this conversation somewhere. It sounds like we should carry on.
I feel you may be a repeat guest at some point soon. And if not, at the fourth Tuesday of the month at 5 p.m. at Green Park, London.
I also look forward to that conversation as well. I enjoy that a lot, Tom.
We'll talk sometime soon. Many thanks for coming on, Adrian.
Yes, Tom. Thanks for having me.